There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LeBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day? If Jesus has a mind, then we just can't just think anything about anything. There's a specific way that Jesus is thinking about the matters of the day. So what is that? How do we cultivate the mind of Christ in order that we can bring that mind to bear in our conversations with others? Let's face it, people don't need just another piece of our mind. They do very much need the peace of the mind of Christ. So how do we give that to them? Hey, I invite you to connect with us online. Our website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LeBurge. Folks, racial reconciliation and...
There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Well, welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LeBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in His place, back where He belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. Sorry for that little hiccup at the beginning of the hour. I'm here with you live now. You can visit me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can let us know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LeBurge. I'm going to consider this college day here on The Reconnect. We're going to talk during this part of the show about colleges. Why are we doing that? Well, colleges actually expect to be hearing from graduating high school seniors who received acceptance letters. They expect to be hearing from those students by or around May 1st. That means that millions of families across America, including maybe your own, are in the midst of talking about and counting the cost of college. College education here in the United States is a very expensive proposition in most places. And it's not only a matter of money, it's also a matter of culture, a matter of environment. Who your kids are going to be with, what are they going to be exposed to, what are they going to be able to do with that degree once they graduate? In all likelihood, they will meet someone in college, get part of their life for the years going ahead. Just think about if you had a college experience. How formative was that for you? Did it change the way you thought about the world? Did it change the way that maybe changes the way you think about what you do in the world? I know that for me, had I not been with a group of Christian students on the campus of the University of Florida, the choices that I made during college may have been very, very different. And indeed, the things that I have had the opportunity to do since then and my ability to look my kids in the eye today and say, you know what, I didn't do that, and you shouldn't do that either. And so I think that some of those value judgments that we make during the college years, you know, a lot of that is influenced by who we're with, and who we're with is influenced by where we go to school. Christian colleges are certainly an option. There are lots of them out there. But lots of Christians are going to send their kids to secular schools for reasons that range from generational legacy to sports to historic reputation, to scholarships, to the major option that a student wants to pursue. College life is definitely different than it was when I started college in 1986. And every kid is different in terms of the environment in which they have grown up and the environment in which they're going to best thrive as a college student. But there are some things going on in American higher education that parents need to know. And these are not things that colleges are going to tell you in their view book. These are not things that they're going to be advertising to you when you go to those campus visits. And this is a free speech conversation that if you're not aware of that's happening on college campuses right now, this is something that you need to become informed about as a parent or a grandparent who is a part of the ongoing conversation that kids are having as they pursue the choice of where to go to college. So today, I'm just going to call it College Day here on the Reconnect. We're going to take a tour of some college campuses. We're going to include everything from the Ivy League to Berkeley to the national champion Clemson Tigers. We're going to start with a really quick visit to the University of California at Berkeley. You may remember UC Berkeley as a place where the free speech movement really began a generation ago. Well, UC Berkeley is now a place where free speech is definitely not celebrated. In fact, Ann Coulter has just been prevented from speaking at the UC Berkeley campus just in the last 24 hours. So let's visit the campus of Wesley. Now, Wesley is one of the most elite colleges for women in all of America. Wesley is where Hillary Clinton went to school. Wesley is not a college where free speech, at least in the form of speech that some might find offensive, is welcome. Wesley now welcomes free speech as long as that speech is speech with which they agree. Now, it's interesting to note that Wesley is also an all-women's college that now welcomes applicants of every variety except those who are born biologically male and continue to identify as male. So anyway, that's a whole other curious topic that I just put in here because, you know, I found it kind of fascinating, a fascinating factoid that I learned as I was researching what's going on at Wesley these days. So here's the story out of Wesley. Wesley has an op-ed published on April the 12th in the Wesley News that's entitled, Free Speech is Not Violated at Wesley. This is a staff editorial, and here is the lead paragraph. Many members of our community, including students, alumni, and faculty, have criticized the Wesley community for becoming an environment where free speech is not allowed or is a violated right. Many outside sources have painted us as a bunch of hothouse flowers who cannot exist in the real world. Now listen to this sentence, friends. However, we fundamentally disagree with that characterization, and we disagree with the idea that free speech is infringed upon at Wesley. Rather, our Wesley community will not stand for hate speech and will call it out when possible. Note there that they disagree with the idea that free speech is infringed upon whenever it is that they call out whatever they determine to be hate speech. Now, in this particular case, Wesley is a private college. They can limit anybody's speech any way they want to. And so I suppose that people need to know that going in. Your speech is going to be limited. And hey, by the way, the speech that they're talking about was apparently in exchanges of private emails, which is why none of us have actually seen the content of what all of this hubbub is about. But let's just consider that for a moment. In private emails exchanged between individuals, things were said that now rise to the level of a campus newspaper, the editors of the campus newspaper, saying, if you say these things, this is not okay at Wesley. Okay, and you say to yourself, well, maybe it's just happening at Wesley. No. The editorial at Wesley College actually called for shutting down forms of rhetoric that they viewed as problematic. And they're not alone. There are schools all across the country where this is taking place. In fact, if we go from the East Coast to the West Coast and we visit Pomona College, Pomona is one of the colleges that is in the Claremont College system in California. And in an open letter to outgoing Pomona College president David Oxtoby, a group of students from the Claremont Colleges who identify themselves as, let me get the number correct here, three self-identified black students at Pomona College, they wrote this letter of demand. They assailed the president for affirming Pomona's commitment to free speech and instead demanded that all five colleges in the Claremont system, quote, take action against the conservative journalists that are on the staff of the Claremont Independent. So they want the not just the campus president to change his viewpoint in relationship to free speech on their campus. They are demanding, and actually they set a date and a time by which the president was required to respond to their demands. And here's what their open letter basically says. And this is, remember, this is about free speech. Free speech, they argue, a right many freedom movements have fought for, has recently become a tool appropriated by hegemonic institutions. Now, hegemonic is used here to mean institutions of higher education and otherwise that are being oppressive. They're acting in oppressive ways. It's not just empowered. It has not just empowered students from marginalized backgrounds to voice their qualms, which obviously these students think free speech is supposed to be about, and criticize aspects of the institution, also which they think free speech should be protected. But it has given those who seek to perpetuate systems of domination a platform to project their bigotry. Well, guess what? Guess what? That's what free speech is. And you are exercising the right of free speech in even sending such a demand letter to the outgoing president of Pomona College. This is an act of free speech demanding that the free speech of others be curtailed because they are saying things with which we do not agree. Now, why does this matter from a Christian worldview? Well, because the attitude that is being cultivated among college students in America, and again, I think that we absolutely have to point out that the overwhelming majority of students at colleges across America, they're not engaged in these kinds of protests. They're not engaged in these kinds of conversations. They're not harming people who are coming to campus with different viewpoints. All of these kinds of things that are taking place are actually ignited by and participated in by a fairly small number of people. However, it doesn't take very many people to mug a guy coming onto campus to give a speech, which is precisely what happened, I don't know, it was like 46 days ago, 47 days ago now, that a visiting professor, Charles Murray, was prevented from speaking, was attacked by a mob as he tried to flee the Middlebury College campus. No one has yet to be arrested or expelled. But the event has provoked conversation on the campus and across the world of higher ed in relationship to free speech and what free speech is and how free a person is allowed to speak and the breadth of diversity of opinions that we are going to entertain on any college campus at any given period of time. So it's actually getting, I think, harder to deny that there is a censorship problem at American colleges and universities. Here's just a quick rundown. Just in the 2016-2017 academic year, that has seen a transgender film director harassed at Reed College. Windows were smashed at the University of California, Berkeley. A controversial speaker was maced at American University. Liberal professors were sent to the emergency room with a neck injury because they dared to have a conversation with Charles Murray. Remember Charles Murray? He's the guy that we were just talking about. Well, what was Charles Murray going to talk about that was so provocative, so controversial? Well, Charles Murray is an American Enterprise Institute fellow and an author of The Bell Curve and Coming Apart. It's worth noting that Cornell University professors Wendy Williams and Stephen Secchi recently surveyed dozens of professors for the New York Times because they really wanted to know, when it comes to what Charles Murray was going to say, just how provocative was his talk going to be. So Charles Murray is a political scientist. He attempted to deliver a speech at Middlebury College in Vermont. He was invited to do so. But before he arrived, an open letter to the college was sent from alumni protesting that his opinions were, quote, deceptive statistics masking unfounded bigotry. Now, is that what they were? Well, his speech was actually based on his 2012 book, Coming Apart, which is an analysis of the predicament of the white working class in the United States of America. He was shouted down by student and faculty protesters. They were accusing him of being a racist and a white supremacist, and some of the protesters became unruly and physically violent, forcing Mr. Murray to actually flee the scene. He ended up giving a version of his talk via a live stream later in the day. And so these two journalists, Wendy Williams and Stephen Secchi, thought, you know what, let's find out just how provocative his talk is or was. And so they sent it out. They sent the text of it out to 70 college professors, women and men of different ranks and different universities, and they asked them to rate the material on a scale from 1 to 9, ranging from very liberal to very conservative, with 5 defined as middle of the road. He also offered them a chance to explain why they gave the material that kind of... and so when they did this, 57 of the 70 responded and gave Mr. Murray's talk an average score of 5.05, or, well, the middle of the road. Now, additionally, they sent the transcripts to another group of 70 college professors who were actually told that it was Mr. Murray. 44 of those 70 responded and gave it an average rating of 5.77. Again, obviously, they were skewed by knowing that Mr. Murray was giving the talk, but still, 5.77, not very far from the middle of the road. So the accusation that it was going to be too provocative, the accusation that it was going to be racist, the accusation that it was going to be, you know, too much for the students of Middlebury to handle, wasn't even true on the face of it. Wasn't even true on the face of it. And this really gets to the point when we start talking about from a Christian worldview, can we handle the truth? Can people handle the truth? Well, we as Christians need to be people who handle the truth very, very carefully. We recognize that there is some speech that is hateful, and we don't want to be people who participate in that, and we don't want to be people who certainly defend those who participate in that. But we are also people who need to defend the free exchange of ideas. Christianity wins the day, wins the argument in an environment of the free exchange of ideas. Do you remember when Paul preached in Athens? You know, the whole conversation there is that the Christian, the truth of the Christian gospel is able to handle itself in an environment of real dialogue, real debate, real intellectual rigor. Like, the truth is enough. And the truth doesn't necessarily need defending, but the truth does need articulating. And so that's you and I, that's the responsibility that we have as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. You and I speak, we open our mouths. Well, that is free speech. And if we're going to, on our college campuses, be shutting down diversity of opinion that's considered by some to be hate speech, I want you to just imagine for a moment passages of the Bible that would fall into that particular category in some people's minds. Now, I'm not just picking on these schools. There actually are plenty of other examples of things like this going on across the country. And Harvard's a school you might recognize the name of. Harvard actually has a verse of its alma mater that references and gives honor to the Puritans, its Puritan heritage. Well, Harvard, they don't really want to be doing that anymore. So they are now seeking to have people rewrite and submit rewritten new verses for Harvard's alma mater, in order that inclusion would rise to the level, would be at center stage. Here's really the issue. They don't want to have anybody think that the pursuit of truth would lead to a certain endpoint, and that, they argue, the Puritan position, therefore, is just not one that they want to advocate nor defend. Well, just think about that for just a moment. We're going to scrub the alma mater of the Puritans. Now, that may not be unlike Yale trying to scrub Calhoun from its heritage by removing Calhoun's name from a college there because of his role in the slave trade and his ideas about white supremacy, all of which we understand and all of which we have talked about on the program before. which takes me to Georgetown, which has apologized for its role in the slave trade just recently. And if you're not familiar with that story, I think it's particularly redemptive on this front. Well, I'm betting by now you are thinking to yourself about Christian colleges and Christian college options. There are many, and they too are quite diverse in terms of ideology and the level of
commitment. And so, if you want to consider Christian colleges, you know, I've some in mind that I would send you to, probably above others. Here's the real challenge I think that each and every one of us faces. You are going to not only invest a lot of your hard-earned money into a college education, but you're going to actually entrust your kid to the ideology of a group of faculty and a campus environment where your kid is either going to be strengthened in their walk for Christ, or they are going to be constantly challenged. And you kind of have to decide as a parent, what's my kid ready for, first of all, and what am I ready for as a parent? Because the kid who's going to come home from a very secular college where only one set of ideas is accepted, if that's not the set of ideas that you're sending them with, it will be the set of ideas with which they come home. So you just have to know that going in. It's very, very difficult for a Christian kid who is not equipped and prepared to bring God back into every conversation. It's just really hard to send them into a highly secularized environment of higher education today. So, news from one school that has was historically related to the Baptist Church made the news yesterday. Baylor in Waco, Texas, has named a new president, and for the first time in its 172-year history, that president is a woman. That's an interesting set of conversations and an interesting storyline to examine as well. All right, so I've kind of picked my way across the country. I think I will land this plane in terms of college day. I think I'll land this plane at UCLA. Here's what's going on out there in terms of free speech. There's a free speech course offered at UCLA by a professor named Keith Fink. Now, he's a conservative UCLA professor. He's been fighting for months against efforts by his new department chair to limit the number of students who can enroll in his class. Why? Because his class is one of the most popular on campus. It's called Free Speech in the Workplace. He previously taught in a 292-seat lecture hall that was packed out to capacity. And it's now he's now having to offer it in a place that only seats like 150 students. So the department chair, Kerry Johnson, claims that the restrictions are designed to ensure high quality of instruction. But Fink says that the concern is unfounded, calling it a pretext for limiting access to the course. It's just kind of curious that you would limit access to a communications course on free speech. Now, why would you want to limit access to a course on free speech? Well, because you didn't like the viewpoint of the person teaching the class. So as you consider, again, how you're going to engage in conversations in a way that honors Jesus, you know, you got to be able to take your conversations out into the public square in such a way that we present things honestly, forthrightly, truthfully, recognizing that if we are people of truth who are carefully handling the truth, then we are ultimately free because we're not speaking our own mind. Keep in mind that if you have over time cultivated the mind of Christ in the matters of the day, then your exercise of free speech is an exercise of freely speaking the mind of Christ. So my encouragement to you today is to continue to cultivate your ability to discern the mind of Christ in the matters of the day. And then I really want you to reach out to college age people, and I want you to have this conversation about free speech and viewpoint discrimination. And I want you to ask them, you know, why is it that you think people don't want to hear from a variety of viewpoints? You know, in Christianity, we call it iron sharpening iron, right? I mean, like, I actually want to be, I want to become better. I want to become more thoughtful. If there's truth that I'm missing, I want you to help me work my way to it. And I recognize that I am not yet perfected. All right, friends, hey, The Reconnect is a listener-supported ministry by people just like you. Go to reconnectwithcarmen.com and check it out. You get resources for you there, previous programs, interviews, and posts. Certainly be thankful for your help. Reconnectwithcarmen.com. We'll be right back.
Started something good.
This is Carmen LaBurge. You are listening to The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we are talking about here what everybody is talking about. We'd love to be talking about the breaking news of the day with people who know a lot about it. We're seeking to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. We invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, one of the people who pushes the buttons to make breaking news happen. That's probably not the way she interprets her job, but that's the way I think about it. Her name is Lee Munsell. She's actually the breaking news editor at CNN. She has worked at The Blaze, Politico, The Dallas Morning News, The Orange County Register, The Arizona Republic, and The Arizona Capital Times, which makes her sound like a person who's much older than she actually is. But you can follow her on Twitter at Lee Munsell, and you can check her out at leemunsell.com. From her bio page, she says this: "Hey, I'm Lee. I'm a Washington, D.C.-based journalist covering the 2016 elections. Her specialties include running a team of reporters, coordinating coverage, and making placement decisions. That's really the part I want to talk with her about. How do you actually decide what breaking news is? All right, friends, welcome her. It's Lee Munsell back with us on The Reconnect. Welcome, Lee.
Hello, Carmen. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Okay, so that's my lead-off question. So you're the breaking news editor at CNN. How do you actually decide what is breaking news?
Well, a lot of it is just kind of using your best news judgment, but also a lot of times I don't really get to decide. Something breaks and becomes kind of the talk of the town or the story of the day. Something's happening, and we kind of just have to jump on it. So it's using a lot of instinct and kind of sorting through what's going to be a big deal and what's going to kind of go away. But also a lot of it is just kind of self-explanatory. News breaks and you kind of know it when you see it, right?
So, well, we appreciate that you know when you see it because we then, right? Because like we are consumers of what you tell us the breaking news is. And so I just think that that's like a curious, it's like curious for us to imagine people who aren't making that decision on a moment by moment or day to day basis. Hey, this is the thing that people need to know, because there's certainly more things that you could choose from. I mean, right? I mean, there's always something happening on every street corner. So, so can you just tell us, like, when you say it's journalistic instinct, can you just give us a little insight into that?
Sure. Well, kind of a way to explain it is that we have reporters in a number of different areas. So whether we're talking about the justice area with the Supreme Court, we have reporters who are experts in that. We have reporters who are experts in national security, who know a lot about various conflicts that are happening around the globe. Some of them are based internationally. Some of them are based at the Pentagon. Some of them are based on the Hill, talking to members of Congress about national security things. And so we have a lot of different people in a lot of different places who are experts on any number of things. So when something kind of bubbles up on their beats or in their area that they know is going to be a big deal, they pass it on. And then we kind of decide from there what the story is going to look like, what the coverage plan is going to look like, how that's going to look on the website, how important it is in the scheme of what's going on that day and in the scheme of what's going on in the next couple of weeks, kind of having a sense of the lay of the land politically, how, for example, if we decide to do airstrikes in Syria, what that looks like for the White House, for the administration, what that looks like on the Hill, whether there's going to be an authorization for the use of military force, what that sort of debate is going to look like on the Hill. And so kind of knowing what the ongoing storylines are, as well as little blips of breaking news that happen within each of those areas and how they're going to affect the overall storyline. It really is, I mean, my job, honestly, is to interact with news just all the time. So the average consumer kind of pays attention in the morning or pays attention at night before they log off, pays attention during their lunch break. They kind of click around and see what the news of the day is. But we're watching it all day, every day. We're watching Twitter. We're watching, you know, everything that's happening. We have a thing called Data Miner, which picks up if a tweet starts taking off and people are really talking about it. I get an email right away. So if something is kind of going viral, we know instantly. And so kind of sorting through all that information, deciding what people are going to be interested in, and then how to put that on the website in a way that people can pay attention.
All right. I love that you are able to survey all of that. And you mentioned very, very quickly there that, you know, you've got people positioned in all kinds of strategic places where news is very likely to happen, let's say the Hill or the Pentagon, certainly internationally. And then the other thing that you pointed out there is that there's breaking news that is often a part of what is already an ongoing story. And so is there any breaking news that we need to know about that we might have missed in the last few hours in relationship to the ongoing and unfolding story of Bill O'Reilly at Fox?
You know, nothing specifically is broken today. The majority of that story kind of unfolded yesterday when Fox decided to break ties with Bill O'Reilly. And I guess if you want to know the latest, Sarah Palin is supposed to be on CNN. We have an interview with her that's exclusive that should air shortly. If it's not airing now, I'm trying to look at a screen across the newsroom and see if it's on yet. But she's going to kind of weigh in. As you know, Sarah Palin was a former Fox News contributor, and she weighs in that interview on what she feels like the culture toward women at Fox News was and continues to be. So that should happen anytime now.
All right. Well, let's move to the first week of Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court and what the Supreme Court has been up to this week. What, from your viewpoint, what is happening there that's like, I mean, it's so newsworthy. Like, everything they do is newsworthy. So absolutely. Is there a nugget that you pick from that and that you kind of suss out to share with us because you think we're going to be particularly interested in it?
Yeah, I think there's a religious liberty case that should get heard by the Supreme Court anytime now. It's very shortly supposed to be heard, unless they decide not to hear it, which is always an option for the Supreme Court. But there's a case that we've been talking about that deals with a school and a church school, a preschool that's run by Trinity Lutheran Church, and it was denied a grant to participate in a state program to get like recycled tires from cars and use that to create like a softer playground surface. And so this school, which is run by a church, tried to opt into that program in Missouri. The initiative was launched in 2012. So they tried to opt into that program, but they were told that they were unable to opt into that program because of separation of church and state, or the idea that that would then be a program that was benefiting a religious institution rather than a school. And so that court case now, they sued, and the Alliance Defending Freedom, which your viewers, listeners, that's what we're maybe familiar with, the Alliance Defending Freedom, is defending Trinity Lutheran in that case. And so now it's gone through any number of appeals processes and now has gone all the way up to the Supreme Court and could be decided on very shortly. So it's a small instance, obviously, but as in the case of pretty much every Supreme Court case, it's a small case. It has a lot of specifics to it, but it has larger implications, in this case, on religious freedom, what that looks like, what the state's responsibility to religious institutions is, and whether a school like this can participate in a program like this, and whether it's unfair to stop this school from participating in a program that's open to every other school just because they're affiliated with a church. And so, again, it's kind of a small case, but it has larger implications.
So you are hearing the voice of Lee Munsell. She's a breaking news... Oh, gosh. Is it? It probably has a big fancy title. Breaking news editor at CNN. You can follow her on Twitter at Lee Munsell. You can also check her out at leemunsell.com. So, Lee, my listeners are actually very familiar with that Trinity Lutheran case that you are alluding to. We talked about it some yesterday. And I would say from a news perspective, things that I would be looking for in that decision and storylines that I think are likely to appear that are larger than maybe other people are thinking about. Mm-hmm. The Blaine Amendment, which is essentially what the state of Missouri is defending in its state law, it actually exists in like 37 states across the country. So if the Supremes strike the efficacy of the Blaine Amendment in Missouri, it gets stricken in every other state in the union. So I think it's actually a small case with really potentially huge implications on that front. The other front that I don't hear anybody talking about, but has implications in this conversation, is if on a federal level, we are going to, under Education Secretary DeVos, move in the direction of school vouchers, this case is seminal. Because you can't do school vouchers with federal funding in a state that has a Blaine Amendment. I mean, like it would just be fighting it out everywhere. So I actually think this is a super duper interesting case, and I'm so glad. Yeah. I'm so glad that you are thinking about it as breaking news, because I think it is too. Hey, let's talk about. Have you got an update for us, maybe on George Bush's hospitalization?
The last I heard, again, that was yesterday that kind of came out that President H.W. Bush had been hospitalized once more. He was hospitalized earlier this year for pneumonia, and it seems that this instance was related to pneumonia as well. But his spokesman yesterday said that he's doing well. He's returned home, and they cleared up this last bout of pneumonia. So that's the latest I heard. I guess that was last night that we heard about it. But by now he should be home already and resting there.
Well, that's good. That's good news. So we love it when you guys at CNN give us some good breaking news. And we certainly appreciate that moment by moment coverage. None of us are in a position to pay attention to all of those data streams that you are referring to. And none of us have, you know, a friend on the Hill and a friend at the Pentagon and a friend internationally who's going to, you know, buzz us when something's happening where they are. And so I hope you recognize the value that we all see, that we all appreciate in the ability of CNN and other news agencies like yours to really have your finger on the pulse of what's happening everywhere. And to let us know, like, it is, it's a great benefit to live in a time when technology, makes it possible for us all to get breaking news. But it's also wonderful to know the people who have their literal finger on the pulse of that, because you have to be sensitive to what it is that we want to know or what it is that we need to know. And so thank you for giving us a little insight into how that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. You're welcome. And feel free to go to cnnpolitics.com, and you can see all of our latest reporting, everything we're working on today. And we're going to be updating, you know, through the evening, as always. So take a look at what we've been writing.
Fantastic. That's Lee Munsell. She's the breaking news editor at CNN. You can follow her on Twitter at Lee Munsell. Lee, thank you for being with us again today on The Reconnect.
Thank you for having me.
All right, y'all. It's just fun to get to talk to people over time, and even as their own careers evolve, and even as they move from one news reporting agency to another, it is wonderful to have the kind of relationship with the news media where we can actually get some insight into, you know, how the news is being gathered and then delivered to us, because there's a decision made all along the way in terms of what is news. And so you and I as Christians, when we think about what is news, why are we reading what we're reading? Why are we passing on via our social media what we're passing on? Why are we declaring to others the good news of the gospel? And what is our role and responsibility in that, in terms of literally keeping our finger on the pulse of what's happening in the world, in order that we can actually be the people who bring God's perspective to bear on the news of the day and in a situation? And that's what we hope we're equipping you to do here today. All right, friends, this point in the show, we go below the fold, lift up stories, and make connections designed to help you start or engage with others in conversations that may not initially appear to be about God, but where the introduction of eternal principles could help change not only the conversation, but maybe the course of the way another person is thinking. And ultimately, you and I both know, if a person changes the way they think, they're going to change the way they live. All right, you might remember our conversation about the oldest living person in the world dying. And so that was Miss Morano. She lived in Italy. She was 117. She's the last known person to live in all three centuries. She was born in the 1800s in 1899, lived throughout the entirety of the 1900s, the 20th century, and died in the year 2017, so into the 21st century. Well, as soon as the oldest known person dies, what position becomes available? That's right, the oldest known person position. So the position now of world's oldest known person, world's oldest person, is a woman in Jamaica. She's 117 years old, and she is described as a church-loving woman. She is the new oldest person in the world. And she says, "I eat what I want, but no pork or chicken." And the Jamaica-born 117-year-old abstains from what she calls rum and dim things. So you don't want to be imbibing in rum and dim things if you want to live to be 117. So born in March of 1900, Violet Moses Brown, she once told a hometown newspaper there in Jamaica that hard work, devotion to the Baptist Church, and respect for family, life, and people in general is what has helped her to live a long and a happy life. She said, quoting the Old Testament, honor your mother and your father so your days may be long. She said, I love the church. She actually hails from the same part of the island of Jamaica as Olympic champion Usain Bolt. And on Saturday, she became the world's oldest person, as I mentioned, after the death of Emma Morano in Italy. So what do you want to know about the new oldest person in the world today? Well, she was baptized at the age of 13, and she made contributions to the church over many, many decades. She received a plaque at the age of 107 from the Baptist Association there in Trelawney. And she is affectionately known as Aunt V. Aunt V. All right. So she likes fish. And she sometimes, this is kind of funny, sometimes she will eat a cow foot. I don't actually know how you would eat a cow foot. So I can't really, I think that maybe something there is lost in translation. She swears by the local produce of sweet potatoes, breadfruit, oranges, and mangoes. All right. So why bring that up? Well, because when you and I think about life and we think about the joy of living and we think about birthdays, I think that we ought to be people who also celebrate rebirthdays, right? She was baptized when she was 13. I just want you to think about the fact that she lived, you know, she lived her life as a child of God. So at the age of 13, which my math is bad, but I think that that is like 104 years ago. So 104 years ago, she gave her life intentionally to Jesus Christ, and she was baptized into the faith. And I think she would say, you know, I died to sin. I don't drink rum and dim things. She is a person who has lived a beautiful life from all accounts. And I want to move to from this conversation about life to a conversation about beauty, because another big trending thing out there right now is that Julia Roberts is named the world's most beautiful woman by People for the fifth time. So five times over, oh gosh, 25 years, I think, Julia Roberts has been named the world's most beautiful woman. So the first time she received the title was 26 years ago, and she turns 50 this year. So she's received the award five times. And I bring this up because we have the world's oldest living person, who is 117, who by the world's definition of beauty, maybe has lost some of what we would consider Julia Roberts to have in terms of her physical attractiveness. And we look at a person like Julia Roberts and we say, hey, she's the world's most beautiful woman. By what standard? By whose standard? Now, while I totally appreciate that a woman who turns 50 this year is described as the world's most beautiful woman, she's a person who is described as staying forever young, I thought this would be a good opportunity today to touch on the subject of beauty. So recently, with my family, I saw Beauty and the Beast, the live action movie, which, by the way, criticisms of it are just grossly overrated, even my own. So we all know beauty. And we all know its corollary when we see it. That's the reason that Beauty and the Beast actually like makes sense to us on a heart level. Indeed, there's something deep within us that's like intrinsically drawn to that which is beautiful. Now, theologically, that human desire for beauty and the attractiveness of it, that's called an aesthetic appetite. You actually have an aesthetic appetite. You have an appetite for that which is beautiful. And while philosophers might try to tell us that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, reality is, beauty is one of the three transcendental virtues that exist because God is who God is. Goodness, beauty, and truth are what they are and exist in reality because of who God is, because of the very nature of God himself. Now, our culture has become incredibly confused about lots of things, and beauty is one of them. Beauty, like goodness and truth, is what we might think of as a contested category in the culture today. In much the same way that people have exchanged the truth about God for lies and confused good for evil and evil for good, so too there is a deep confusion about what is genuinely beautiful. Because beauty is not just that which is pretty or attractive or pleasing to the eye. I got to tell you, this woman in Jamaica who's 117 years old, she is beautiful. She's a beautiful life. She's a beautiful spirit. She's a beautiful testimony. Beauty can be found in events and realities as grotesque as a naked, brutalized man dying on a cross, if you know who he is and if you know why he's dying, and if your heart and mind know exactly what it is that you behold on that cross. You see, the particular confusion over beauty is one of surface versus depth, or subjectivity versus objectivity. Because from a biblical worldview, beauty is as objective as truth. It is an objective reality, even though it's not always easily observed on the surface of things. So we could survey over the course of Christian history lots of theological thoughts on the subject of beauty. But here's ultimately, I think, what we have to begin to recognize. God is ultimately the one who defines what is good because God is good. And God is the one who defines what is true because God is truth. And God is the one who defines what is beautiful because God alone is beautiful. He's the one that's real, and he's the one who defines these categories. So with all of that said, is the most beautiful woman in the world the one on the cover of Time magazine, who, by all accounts, is a beautiful person? Or is the most beautiful woman in the world the woman whose life and heart and mind is completely given over to Jesus Christ in ways that glorify him beyond the surface things of life? Beauty is not so much a matter of taste as a matter of truth. And it's our appetites and our desires and our way of judging the relative beauty has to be subjected to Jesus Christ. This is one of the areas in which we are not yet fully conformed to the way Christ thinks about things. It would be a violation of the character of God. It would be idolatry to call something beautiful that is not good or not true, because you cannot chop God up that way. You can't sever the Trinity from itself any more than you can sever these virtues of goodness, beauty, and truth. So beauty is both intrinsic, it is there to behold, and beauty is something that we cultivate over time, as in all ways and in all ways, we glorify God. So beauty is what we are to God who beholds us, and it is what we behold when we behold God. So I want you to think of it as a harmony. I want you to think of it as the fullness of reconciliation, walking together in joy and peace with the Lord. I mean, what could be more beautiful? All right, friends, that is literally all we've got time for today. Thank you for joining me here today on The Reconnect. Visit me at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Sign up for the podcast. Donate to the ministry. Share today's show with someone new. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.